We have Senate file 1117 before us, Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, we've completed the testimony as I understand it, so I stand ready to answer questions. I will respond to the questions as best I can and fit in my follow-up remarks to the testimony along the way.
Senator Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Senator Latz, I won't ask you any questions on hunting or the finer parts of the operations of any of these weapons, but...
Just stick to the bill, Senator Howell.
I will. I've got some questions on lines 11.30 and 13.12 and through 13.14. It talks about firearms and what they can do when they become abandoned. So my question is what, when does a firearm, when they're being held in those situations, be considered to be abandoned?
Senator Latz.
Senator Howell, could you identify? I've got 11.30. I didn't catch the other line numbers.
Senator
Howell.
Something.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
13.12 to 14.
13.12 to 13.14.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
Senator Howell, the statute does not define it. It does provide for the dealer or agency to establish policies and that they provide notice prior to disposal of abandoned firearms. So I guess whatever they determine, as long as the most important part is that notice be sent out so that the owner of the firearms has the opportunity to sort that out.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair and Senator Latz. I guess my concern there is I think we need to give some more guidance there as far as what an abandoned firearm means and exactly what that process is for notification of the owner. The other piece of question I have is in 11.26, it discusses about possession does not mean title or ownership. But the question I have is, can they, because those who are holding those firearms, can they use them?
Senator Latz.
Now, Madam Chair and Senator Howe, they're in storage, so I don't see any basis for them using them.
And I would prefer
Senator
to
Howe.
See, thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Latz. I'd like to see something that tightens that up because nothing says that they can't actually just decide that. As long as they have them, they can put them into good use. And then I guess what I have is, what will this do for those that have protection orders against others right now? As far as I know, no one's going out to these folks that have protection orders against them and collecting those firearms now. I notice in here it requires them now to the courts to demand that they get those things transferred. I think one of the reasons that nobody wants to go out there and do it now is it's a highly volatile situation, I would have to believe, because you've got someone that's noticeably probably unstable and now you're going to knock on their door and take their firearm. I'm glad I'm not that officer. So I'm concerned about that, and I'm concerned about what they're going to do, how this affects them. I guess I'd ask that question. Is there anything in here that's going to actually provide for those folks that are currently under protection orders to actually turn in their firearms?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Howell, there's nothing specific in this bill because that's a different subject area. I agree with you that it's a problem. Typically what happens is there's an order for the court when someone is convicted of a disqualifying offense, there is typically a firearms order that's signed by the court at the same time of sentencing and the entry of the conviction. And the firearms order is delivered or served on the defendant if it's that generation, or if there's an order for protection that goes into place, then I think the ordinary process would be for a firearms order to be sent along with a copy of the order for protection. Right now, for the most part, as far as I'm aware, it's kind of a trust them to turn in the firearms situation. There's typically a court may issue an order, but the courts don't enforce their own orders. Usually it's one of the parties to a proceeding that attempts to enforce a court's order one way or another. This is an issue throughout Minnesota, and there have been proposals in other bills for there to be automatic follow-up hearings by the court to verify whether or not firearms have been turned in compliance with their orders. There are some judges I know from a news report in Wisconsin where one judge took it upon herself to set up a whole process to verify follow-up on those orders. It would be a lot of judicial resources to have those kind of automatic follow-up hearings for every order that they issue that would require firearms to be turned in. So it's a difficult area to difficult problem to solve. We are attempting to solve it specifically in this bill with this particular situation as we are proposing. And I mean, I agree with you. I don't think I'd want to be the officer to go in and enforce that order either. On the other hand, it might very well save the life of the person that's inside with the guns, or life of others residing with them, or others as well. And honestly, I can't think of anyone else in society that is better suited or trained, let alone designated to deal with issues relating to firearms like this, than our law enforcement officers.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Latz. I guess my concern is I know someone that did death by suicide by cop. And I believe this is actually going to, as one of the testifiers said, this is going to actually do nothing to stop that. I think it's going to actually increase, and that's my concern. So I'll leave it at that, and I guess I got some concerns with the bill. So thank you.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Latz,
Senator Howe, thank you for your comments regarding abandoned firearms and allowable use. I've made some notes, and I'm going to go back and see if we need to tighten some language up somewhere along the way on that. Thank you.
Senator Westlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Latz. This is a very important bill. I have a friend who died by suicide in 1991 who had access over the course of his major depressive disorder. Access to firearms. He was in and out of the hospitals. He should have been on a list somewhere where he could not legally purchase a firearm. And we've heard stories today about similar situations, and I don't think anyone in this room would say that these aren't tragedies. I think we all agree that these are tragedies, and I think we all agree that we are trying to find mechanisms to try to reduce risk and reduce harm. And one of the challenges that has always faced us when it comes to gun safety issues is we have always approached it from a criminal justice standpoint instead of a public health standpoint. And when you view it through a public health lens, you approach the problem a little differently. And increasing penalties is not going to have an impact on someone who is having suicidal ideation and is making a plan to maybe take out as many people as possible with them before they die themselves. And what we do know, we heard some information from researchers yesterday. I really can't, this book, The Violence Project, has some really excellent research and information that I think people would find interesting. But the theme over and over again is that folks who are either mass shooters or folks who are experiencing a crisis and threats of suicide These are things that are happening over extended periods of time, and that is why extreme risk protection orders can be effective, because some of the information from the study showed that the behavior actually happens over significant periods of time. In almost 30% of the cases, the crisis is over many months, and for many of these folks, it's the crisis occurs over years. Like 41% of these cases are people who have a long history of challenges, and so really, we've heard repeated testimony today too that if we can thwart someone attempting to die by suicide with a firearm, they actually do not then go on to attempt it again. And so this is about harm reduction. It is about risk reduction. It is about making sure that people have the opportunity to wake up the next morning so that they can get the interventions that they need and live on with their lives. And I will just end with this. There's a great quote in this book, and we often hear in these debates over gun safety issues, that particular law would not have prevented this specific incident. And it's really sort of a straw man argument. And what Dr. Jillian Peterson and Dr. James Densley in their books say this, and I think it's important. They said, there are no quick fixes to systemic social problems. For too long, America has either viewed possible solutions in isolation or created false dichotomies that are pitted against each other, from gun safety measures to mental health treatment. Even when solutions have merit, they are then wrongly dismissed for being imperfect. And what we know is no single law, no two laws are going to completely eliminate gun deaths, gun injuries. We spend no time talking about the people who sustain lifelong injuries, but we do something because it reduces the risk of harm. It reduces the risk of death. It reduces the risk of injury. This bill has due process, and it has penalties I'm not necessarily a fan of for false testimony, but we have that in there. If someone falsely presents a petition, they could be subject to gross misdemeanor prosecution. At the end of the day, this is a bill that will save lives. And I hope that when people are contemplating their vote on this, they will remember that. They will remember the testimony of every single person who sat at the table and talked about the people they lost, who they loved so, so dearly. And this will help families not experience that tragedy, communities not experience that tragedy, and if nothing else, we should be working to try to save lives. Thank you.
Senator Eichorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll have a question first and then a statement after the question. I'm curious about this bill and the other bills we've heard today, as we've heard several counties talk about becoming, dozens of counties becoming, whether they call it Second Amendment Sanctuary County or Second Amendment Dedicated County. 76 county sheriffs coming out against any of the proposals we're seeing today, not from the association side, but from duly elected sheriffs in each of those individual counties, and duly elected county commissioners also putting policies in place that basically are saying, screw you to the state of Minnesota. If you enact this stuff, we're not going to enforce it anyway. So is there any teeth in your bill to do anything there? I mean, what does that look like for the state when, you know, you have all these sheriffs saying, we're not going to enforce this anyway, then what? I mean, what effect are we really having? I'm just kind of curious to hear your thoughts in relation to some of that discussion we've heard on the other side from our duly elected local officials.
Senator Watts.
Madam Chair, Senator Eichorn, it's a little bit challenging to suggest that we as a legislature or as a state ought to somehow be held hostage by our law enforcement officers who are pledging not to enforce the laws of the state. It completely undermines the democracy that we are serving in here today in this committee and in this legislature. They swore on the Constitution when they took office to uphold the laws of the state. If they are now publicly pledging to violate their own oath of office, I think that raises far bigger questions. We have an obligation, I think, as elected officials to do what is in our best judgment for the good of our own districts and for the good of the state as a whole, taking into consideration input from our local elected officials and probably most importantly from our own constituencies, the residents, the citizens of Minnesota that elected us. We know from polling data that red flag laws are widely embraced and endorsed by our constituents, by your constituents, Senator Eichhorn. You may not be hearing from them unless you're doing a statistically valid poll of all the residents in your Senate district. We do know that the people who are most energized by particular policies or proposals are the ones more likely to be vocal about it, to send letters, to contact their legislators, and so on. And for some, it becomes a deciding factor in how they vote, and for some, it's just one of many factors in when they decide how to vote. But if you ask their opinions in a poll, you'll find that a majority, I can't speak to your particular Senate district because I don't have data on that, but certainly statewide, the majority support red flag laws. So I will also note that nationally, this is not a partisan issue. Florida, a Republican legislature and Republican governor enacted their red flag law. Indiana, a solidly red state, has a red flag law. So if you look across, if memory serves me, I think so does Texas, come to think of it, because there were issues in the recent Uvalde shooting as to whether or not their red flag law was implemented. But don't hold me to that. I might not be 100% on that. But for us to feel like sheriffs who pledge not to enforce the law, therefore we ought not to pass a law that we think might save lives, or we, from what the evidence is, will save lives, seems to be acting backwards in a democracy. And so, honestly, I think those sheriffs, they undermine democracy when they pledge not to enforce the laws that they have sworn on oath to uphold by dearth of their office. So there's my unvarnished response, Senator Eichhorn.
Senator Eichhorn.
Thank you for that, Senator Latz. And I will just say kind of in response to that first, you know, our sheriffs, our county commissioners, like us, are duly elected. They have the benefit of democracy as well. They have, like you said, an obligation in their best judgment to serve their constituencies just like we do. And so in this case, many of those sheriffs feel that it is in their best obligation to go down that path. But I'll move on from that now. I do think there's a lot of problems with the bill. You know, I do think it's troubling that that it only confiscates firearms, but no other items that an individual could use to harm themselves or somebody else. I mean, when are we going to be back for hammers and bombs and cars and whatever else somebody could use to harm themselves or somebody else? I think what would be more helpful is if we could do more, investing more in mental health services on that front, because a lot of times, you know, these people that are in those situations, and I know you probably agree, are really struggling emotionally, personally, on the mental health front. I would love to see more on that front. I am interested and happy to see that we are caring about, you know, what happens to Minnesotans and the deaths of Minnesotans. I wish we would take that same kind of care when we talk about the legalization of marijuana, where we heard from some of our law enforcement folks that traffic deaths could go up by as much as 150% in those areas. Those lives should matter too. The other part that I think would be important in addition to the mental health piece is education. We talk about education in so many ways as being, you know, the answer to so many of our social ills. You know, shouldn't, you know, part of the piece to help solve gun violence is education as well. You know, if there was a course, even if you had it at the high school level, that could cover topics such as firearms, how guns work, the history of firearms, the danger they pose, statistics on the role of guns in domestic violence, how to safely use and handle firearms, as well as covering laws surrounding guns, sales, and safety. We tried to do some proposals around that in the Environment Committee that would help get kids outdoors. No Child Left Inside, it was called, but that doesn't go far enough to teach all kids about, you know, how to safely deal with a firearm if they encounter one. I mean, in this state, we're one of the higher states for firearm ownership, and the odds that even if a family isn't a gun owner, that child encounters a gun in somebody else's home or in some place in that state. I think education is important. We talk about education being the great equalizer, and education in this area, I think, could go a long ways in helping protect and help save additional lives. So I would love to see some measures in that area. I don't know if that's through our education committee or our environment committee, but I think that's another piece I think we could see that would be very beneficial as well. I know what we're going to see today is what we're going to see, so I don't have any amendments for today, but a lot of grave concerns about this bill. I share the concerns of the people that were here today. I share the concerns of my county sheriffs that I've spoken to, my county commissioners that I've spoken to, and the individual peoples. And I share Senator Howe's concern about those sheriff's deputies that will ultimately be going to the doors, that will be put in greater harm's way, I think, because of this. I realize your heart's in the right place, but I don't think this is the right method to do it. I don't know what the right method is, but I think this isn't quite the right way at this time. So thank you for the discussion on the Sanctuary County, Senator Latz. I'll move on.
Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Eichhorn, thank you for the thoughtful discussion as well. You know, I came from local elected officialdom, if you will. I was on the city council for 9 years. And I respect that they are democratically elected leaders in their communities. And by definition in our system, there is a certain amount of discretion that is, by its nature, granted to our local officials as to how they approach things, including how they choose to enforce certain laws. Where I have a problem is where there appears to be a thumbing your nose at the existence of laws and a flat-out declaration we are not going to enforce. But that said, I mean, there are county attorneys that choose not to enforce, as a matter of policy, other laws too. And I understand that and I respect that. And they are reflecting the sentiment to some degree or another in their own communities. I respect that as well. I share your passion and concern about mental health issues. And we made some game-changing investments in mental health. Last year, Senator Dreheim was the chief author of it. This year, he's the chief author of a bill that I'm the second author on that would fund some of the gaps in our mental health system as well. There's no doubt that system needs substantial support from this legislature, and I fully support efforts there. And I would agree with you that education is important. You know, whether it becomes a mandated curriculum in high school over gun safety, or whether it becomes some kind of voluntary offering available at, you know, whatever venues there are that can reach gun owners. Even education around safe storage has been talked about as an alternative to mandatory safe storage protocols, which you'll note we are not advancing here this year and not in the Senate anyway. So I'm all for education. But if someone is alone in their home contemplating suicide, probably they're not thinking about what are the safe storage protocols or how are we taught to handle firearms safely. They're thinking about using the firearm for a very serious purpose. And that's why you don't see knives and cars and baseball bats or batons or other items that are or could be used as weapons in this bill. Someone contemplating suicide who tries it with a knife, actually who tries it with any method other than a gun, is going to be successful, I'm told, about 3% of the time. Successful meaning they will complete the act of committing suicide and actually die from it. 3% of the time. They try it with a firearm. I've heard numbers, I think today, 78%. I had once had heard far higher number than that. Guns are different. Guns are just different. You put a gun to your head and you pull the trigger, likelihood is you're going to die. You'd put a knife on your wrist and you slice it, it's going to be a while before you bleed out, frankly, and maybe you got time to think, maybe that's not what I want to do, and to call a friend or family or 911 and say, hey, I need help. If it was a gun, you don't get that second opportunity to cry for help. That's why guns are different. That's why this bill focuses on guns.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz, I was looking over kind of the timetable in the event that an ex parte hearing would take place and then the timing of how a respondent is supposed to react. And it kind of escalates from the government. First, they're given a notice and a time frame to bring their weapons or surrender them over, and you can surrender them to law enforcement or a firearm dealer. But I had a little, I wanted to first follow up with what Senator Eichhorn alluded to regarding sheriffs that may be dissatisfied with this if it becomes law. We could also apply that same question and discussion on the judges that don't follow mandatory sentences on gun crimes either. And I don't know how you urge a third branch of government to follow our policies that we put into state statute when we request a mandatory sentence. But having said that, the bill kind of outlines a model reaction by a citizen. Either what they'll do, at least in the bill, I get an order from a court that I had no knowledge of, and someone's giving me a notice that I have to give up guns in my home. Now, if a person truly has a mental disability or condition, or they have an anger management problem, they may not follow the instructions of bringing their guns dutifully to a gun dealer or a law enforcement agency. The way I see it, they have three choices. They can give up their guns, and then we have to assume that they're giving up all their guns. They can maybe hide their guns if they're a little more rebellious. Or they can load their guns and wait for that police officer to knock at the door. And I did want to point out, having said that the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, in a letter that was presented to our committee earlier today, made mention of their support for the previous Senate bill, but they have a different opinion about this bill. And if I can just quote, the MSA, Minnesota Sheriff's Association, remains neutral on Senate File 1117. And it further says, the language expanding the venue that the petitioner may file an ERPO potentially creates confusion regarding which law enforcement agency is responsible for securing and executing the court order. Further states, Minnesota Sheriff's Association is concerned over allowing family and household members to petition directly to the court. We see potential for misrepresentation, putting the court and eventually law enforcement in a difficult and possible dangerous situation. We expressed our unease with the storage of turned in or seized firearms. Not all sheriff offices have the capacity to store and manage a number of potential firearms. My concern is if it gets down to the point where law enforcement has to go to the house and get those weapons, I'm very concerned about the mental state of that individual. And of course, I'm very concerned about the safety of officers that are going to go in to seize those firearms. And I think maybe the ex parte version could really accelerate that possibility, especially if a person has an anger management issue. If the guns are seized, then you leave a very angry person in their home, possibly with a spouse. And if they have an anger management problem, that spouse has probably been a victim of that condition. But then you leave that individual in the house with all sorts of implements of destruction, knives, baseball bats, tire irons, ropes. I just don't think this, I don't feel comfortable leaving that individual in the home with other family, well, with others, whether they're friends or family. And yet we really don't, we're only concerned about the guns. And so maybe suicide is not the only focus here, but it's also the safety of others. And for that reason, I can't support this. I am very concerned about the ex parte version. I understand the logic behind it, but I also believe in due process right from the very beginning of the government intruding in someone's life.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lotz.
So, Senator Limmer, well, thank you for the thoughtful comments. Let's flip the hypothetical, however. You've got someone who is very distraught and angry, and they're in the house with their spouse and a whole lot of guns. What then? Do you wait until the angry person takes the gun and shoots the spouse before you go in as law enforcement and confront an angry person with a gun? Or if you have reason to believe that you've got an angry person with a gun who might be using the gun against the spouse, do you go in preemptively and try to save the life of the spouse? We require, it's part of their job, our law enforcement officers, to go into dangerous situations every day, and have a great deal of admiration and respect to them for doing it. But that's what we're dealing with. It's very clear constitutionally that one can deprive a person of their property and then have a post-deprivation hearing, as long as it's prompt. As was noted in one of the testifiers, we do that for kids that are in imminent danger. The authorities can go rescue the kids who are in imminent danger and then give the parents a right after the fact to go into court to have review. We do that with driver's licenses following DWIs. Happens 30 or 40,000 times a year in Minnesota, where if they test above the legal limit or if they refuse testing, they lose their license, the order is given immediately, and within 7 days, their license is revoked. They have a right to file a petition to get into court for review of that. It's quite common, and it's absolutely constitutionally sound. Now, it might not meet some other people's understanding or preference or definition of what they think is adequate due process, but in terms of the law, it is absolutely sound. And there are situations where I think we simply have no choice. If you tell someone who is under the standards in the bill for an emergency ex parte order, who's demonstrating an immediate and present danger of either bodily harm to others or taking their life. By the way, please don't do anything. We'll come back in 14 days after you've had a chance to have a hearing in front of a judge, and we'll see if anyone's still alive inside of your residence, or if you are. Can't do it that way. There are some situations where you've got to empower law enforcement to go in and separate the guns from the angry person first. And then they've got a right to have a full judicial hearing and review of that. And ultimately, this isn't law enforcement's decision. It's not an angry neighbor's decision, who, by the way, would not have the right to bring a petition. It's not an angry family member's or a vengeful family member's decision, who would have a right to bring a petition here. It's the decision of the judge, based on the criteria that are set forth in the statute, based on the facts that are laid out in an affidavit, by clear and convincing evidence. And in fact, that threshold is important, and the fact that it's judicial decision making and not other decision making ought to give a fair amount of comfort. No system is perfect, I understand that. But there are the statistics I have seen, and I'm sorry I can't cite you the source of the data, but I've been reading a lot on this stuff. Anywhere from 25 to 75% of petitions under red flag laws in states where they exist are denied by the judge upon review, because the judge concluded that there weren't sufficient facts alleged to just to meet the legal standards for issuing the extreme risk protective order. Now, that probably also does reflect community standards to some degree. And, you know, that's the way our system works. There are some communities where they might be more accepting of it. I suspect that actually the Parkland shooting county is the judges are more likely to issue a protective order there than they would be in other counties. But ultimately, there's a judicial review and decision before there's an issue, an order issued. Sometimes it makes sense to act first and ask questions later, because if you don't act, there might be no point in asking questions later. And that's the pathway that this bill provides.
Okay. I've got a list. We'll go to Senator Westlin and then Senator Crude.
Just briefly, as I noted earlier on page 13, line 13.27, there's a provision here that this bill actually models itself quite closely after the domestic abuse restraining order provisions. The process is very similar, including the ex parte process. The thing that this bill has that I have to say, if I were writing this bill, I don't know that I would put this in here, but it was put in order, I think, to be a compromise position, that if someone knowingly provides materially false information, that they could be subject to a gross misdemeanor. That's a pretty significant penalty. And the fact that an order isn't granted does not necessarily mean that that person has provided materially false information. It just means they didn't meet the highest burden of proof in civil law, which is clear and convincing evidence. The petitioner has to make the case by clear and convincing evidence that the petition should be granted. And my concern about that provision is I think that that may well have a chilling effect on people who maybe want to bring a petition but are afraid to do so. But that was put in there to try to address some of the concerns people often raise. And it has not been my experience as someone who deals frequently with domestic abuse restraining orders and harassment restraining orders, in very rare cases does someone bring a false claim. They just don't. It doesn't mean it never happens, but they just don't. And so for me, that's not a particularly compelling argument against the extreme risk protection order, that there's some concern that there are going to be all of these people filing false petitions. It just does not happen in reality, and the consequences for doing so are fairly significant. Again, this process follows the domestic abuse restraining order process very, very closely, and I think addresses as well as can happen the concerns that are being raised. This is a compromise bill. It has incorporated changes. Again, it's not a perfect bill. If I were writing it, there's stuff in here I might not agree to, but it's a really good bill. And I know Senator Latz and stakeholders have put a lot of time and energy and effort into this. And so, again, I would just ask people to focus concerns on concerns that are real, legitimate concerns, and not concerns that don't necessarily have a basis in reality.
Senator Latz, could you provide some more information about the inclusion of gross misdemeanor that Senator Westland raised?
Yes, Madam Chair. There was a lot of concern raised by opponents of the bill, and as the sheriffs have noted, a concern also in their letter. By the way, the Sheriff's Association has been very constructive in working through a number of issues through this bill. About family members or others being vengeful, angry, harassing, toward someone else and filing a false order. And so we concluded that one way to prevent that is to make it a crime if they did that. Hopefully sufficient disincentive that they will make sure they've got adequate basis for the petition that they bring, the facts that they allege in their affidavit or declaration for the court to consider. So that's why we put the gross misdemeanor crime in there. The general feeling was misdemeanor is probably not enough. Felony is too harsh. Gross misdemeanor is in the middle. So that's where we landed.
Thank you, Senator Latz. Senator Kroon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we do have a mental health crisis that we need to get our arms around, and there's a lot of keep guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them by law. And there are a lot of bills floating around there, including some that I'm on myself, that seek to achieve that. But we are dealing with a constitutional right here. And I'm not discounting any of the stories we heard today. I think, and I hope my words don't get misconstrued that way, my heart goes out to a lot of the people that have been affected. But when I look at this, I look at the constitutional provisions, the implications, I should say, and some of those issues surrounding it, and I'm really uncomfortable with ex parte hearings regarding constitutional rights and a person's constitutional rights being deprived without notice and an opportunity to be heard. And I guess that's fundamentally, and I don't know if there's any way to kind of resolve that through amendments, if that's just a fundamental disagreement on whether or not you should have notice and opportunity to be heard before you're deprived of your constitutional rights. And fundamentally, I think that's what this comes down to. But I think we can work our way through the bill and see. So I understand the A2 amendment change the standard of proof on the first ex parte hearing. If I'm getting that right, it's now probable cause, and that's a change from something else. Maybe you can remind me what the standard of proof is on the first ex parte hearing.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Kroon, you're referring to line 10.26. I want to make sure that we're referring to the same location here. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Kroon, the standard then is probable cause, which is a well-defined and understood concept within the justice community. It's a reasonable belief. That's the easiest way to describe it, a reasonable belief. But then what's very important is what follows on that line, that the respondent poses a significant danger of bodily harm to others or is at significant risk of suicide by possessing a firearm, and two, for the ex parte emergency order, that the respondent presents an immediate and present danger of either bodily harm to others or of taking their life. So it's a two-pronged test, and the judge would have to conclude there's a reasonable belief that both parts of the test have been met. The test itself is pretty significant. So it is still a judge that makes that decision. So a family member or law enforcement are petitioners. They can file a petition. They can make their request. They can submit an affidavit or a declaration of facts to support the petition. Ultimately, the judge makes the judgment call, just like a judge does on warrants, just like a judge does on all criminal charges that are gross misdemeanor or higher that are done by complaint or upon request, even misdemeanor-level offenses.
Senator Kroon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was some discussion about Florida's red flag law, and I think that's one of the differences there, too, in terms of rather than just does the person pose a significant danger, I believe there's objective criteria that the court must look at. And when you're dealing with an ex parte hearing, I think having more objective factors that a judge must look at in issue findings based off would perhaps be helpful to require the court to do, because it is ex parte, because the person that's subject of it didn't get notice, isn't there. And I also believe that Florida's law, it can only be initiated by law enforcement and not a member of the public, which also provides an additional layer of protection. So I don't think we're quite comparing apples to apples when we're looking at Florida's law.
May I respond to that point, Senator Kroon?
Senator Latz.
So therein lies the conundrum here, Senator Kroon. If we rely on law enforcement as the only pathway to judicial determination, while 76 sheriffs have promised they will never participate in this process and stated so publicly, then in those counties, unless there's a local police department that's willing to do it, there is no path to a judge to try to remove a gun from someone who is expressly suicidal. No path whatsoever. When I was working on this a number of years ago, in response to that kind of feedback about the concern about family members, I dropped family members from the bill, from my proposal. Just left it at law enforcement. And since law enforcement has come out and counties are declaring themselves Second Amendment counties and sheriffs are saying we're never going to enforce this law, I've reversed my position, because I can't trust all law enforcement now to, on the objective facts, file a petition with a judge to support a red flag order. I think it's even more important now to have family members have the opportunity to get a petition in front of a court.
Senator Kroon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Latz. I was merely pointing out you're citing Florida as a red state as an example. I'm pointing out there are differences, and I don't really know, and I've not been privy to your conversations with the various stakeholders, but perhaps if the bill was different, I don't know which groups would oppose it or would promise not to enforce it, et cetera, et cetera. It's a different bill. It's a different situation. And I was merely pointing that out, that combined with the objective standards that are in there. And then another concern I have is And again, I know we've heard, you know, ex parte hearings like this take place and orders for protection and that sort of thing, but this is a constitutional right. There isn't a constitutional right for forced contact with somebody against their will who doesn't want it. It's a different type of situation. So I think this should have heightened protections in those situations. And when, and also I believe that the Florida law has an automatic return hearing. The person that has been deprived of their constitutional right doesn't have to specifically seek out that court hearing. So that's another difference. And in that return hearing, if I'm reading the bill, and you can correct me if I'm not reading it correctly, but one concern I have is that while in the ex parte hearing, it's probable cause, significant risk analysis, in the return hearing, the burden then shifts to the person who's been deprived of their constitutional rights, and it's their burden of proof to show that they're not a risk by clear and convincing evidence, which is a heightened standard. So you go from probable cause when they're not there that to lose their constitutional right, then the burden shifts back to them and they have to show that they're not a risk by clear and convincing evidence. And to me, if you're going to have an ex parte hearing, the return hearing should be automatic, number one. You shouldn't have to request it. Number two, it should be the exact same standard, and the burden of proof should remain with the state, and it shouldn't be flipped, and it shouldn't be a heightened standard. I don't know if you have any comments on that.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Krug, can you point out to me the page and line number you're referring to?
Senator Kern.
I have it highlighted here somewhere. There. Maybe I do not have it highlighted. Oh, here it is. I think it's lines 814 to 816. I believe that's the right reference.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruen, I don't think the standard is different between a pre- or a post-deprivation hearing. The petitioner is the law enforcement agency or the family member or whomever. The respondent is the proposed subject of the protective order. And either in all the hearings, it's the petitioner that has the burden of proof, not the respondent. So it doesn't shift the burden in that regard. But while you're at 8.14 to 16, pointing out that at the hearing, the burden of proof goes up from probable cause to clear and convincing evidence. And then, to your point about, you know, what are the criteria, what are the objective standards, there's a list here of such criteria that the court shall consider. And it's itemized here in the bill: a history of threats or acts of violence directed toward another person, history of use or attempted use or threatened use of physical force against another person, violation of any court orders, including cross-references there to firearms statutes, a prior arrest for a violent felony offense, a conviction or prior arrest for a violent misdemeanor offense, stalking offense, or domestic assault, conviction for offensive cruelty to animals, reckless and unlawful use, display, or brandishing of a firearm, suicide attempts by the respondent, or a serious mental illness, whether the respondent is named in an existing order in effect under this or a number of other statutes. So there are objective criteria that are laid out in this proposal for the court to consider. That's not to exclude other criteria that may come in or evidence that may come in, but these at least must be considered. The court shall consider these criteria or this evidence in making the determination.
Senator Kern.
Madam Chair, but thank you, Senator Latz, but by the time you get to that return hearing, you've already been deprived of your constitutional rights. And those factors that you just listed are not required to be considered by the court in the first ex parte hearing. And that's, unless I'm missing it, but I don't see all of those objective criteria in the initial hearing. And so once you get to the return hearing, you've already been deprived of your constitutional right, and that's when the list of objective factors appear.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruen, we disagree and the courts disagree over whether they've been deprived of their constitutional right. The courts have upheld all of these constitutional challenges to red flag laws in states all across the country on due process grounds in that regard. So I understand you may be looking at it a little bit differently in terms of a deprivation of another constitutional provision, the Second Amendment, but the courts respectfully disagree with your conclusion on that, and I'm going with the courts on it.
Senator Cruen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So maybe you can help me here because I'm a little confused on the burden of proof. If you look at 9.29, there's another version of clear and convincing. Are you saying that that is on the burden of the state, the burden of proof is on the state in that section?
Senator Cruen, that has to do with whether or not the court shall seal the petition.
Okay.
In the process.
Senator Cruen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you referenced a disagreement we might have on the constitutionality. I'm merely pointing out that when I say deprived of your constitutional right, I mean it's twofold. One, I do have serious constitutional concerns, but the right to keep and bear arms is a constitutional right, and you've been deprived of it, you could say justly, legally, or I can say illegally.
Constitutionally.
Right. So that was the context in which I said that. But now that you mention it too, you say all the courts have upheld these red flags order, and I'm curious, and perhaps the professor is still here because I believe she made that claim as well, but post-Bruin, have there been any appellate court decisions upholding these red flag laws that you're aware of?
Senator Watts.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruen, I do not know.
Senator Cruen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've not been able to find any appellate decisions, and I'm not sure exactly. I think the professor referenced New York. I'm not sure if that was an appellate decision or if that, I believe that might have just been the New York Supreme Court, which is the lowest court in New York, so there's some confusion sometimes. But I believe that was essentially what we call a district court case as the only one upholding a red flag law post-Bruin. So I think to say that all of the red flag laws out there clearly pass constitutional muster and have been upheld by appellate courts, I think is a stretch, because Bruin would, in my view, change that analysis, or at least could theoretically change that analysis. I think does, but I mean, so I think that is a question that I don't think is as well settled as the testifiers would lead people to believe today. And again, to me, fundamentally, the problem here is lack of notice and opportunity to be heard. And that maybe is just irreconcilable differences fundamentally. And because I've been trying to think about potential amendments, and ultimately I just can't get around that core issue. One issue that one of the testifiers brought up today, too, is the chilling effect on mental health services. I know that a lot of gun owners, their Second Amendment rights are very, very important to them. And if they're struggling with mental health issues and they know that the therapist is, can break confidences and reveal information to law enforcement or whoever that can start this process of them that could end with them losing their firearm rights, they very logically would be deterred from seeking that mental health that I think we all agree we want to encourage. And I'm just wondering if you have responses to that.
Senator Watts.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruen, I share your concerns on that. I do. And so it leaves us in a bit of a quandary. If a therapist knows, they already have, therapists already have a statutory duty to warn someone else that their client is posing a serious threat of physically violent behavior toward someone else. They've got a duty to warn that. So what do you do when the client is posing a significant threat of danger to themselves and is warning the potential target of the behavior enough? So if the therapist calls up, is treating Joe Smith, Joe Smith says something very seriously threatening and gives indication of actually planning to act on it against Jeremy, a neighbor. And the therapist then has a duty to notify Jeremy that Joe Smith is thinking very seriously or is taking steps toward harming you. So there's always already that exposure. Now, that doesn't necessarily threaten Joe Smith's gun rights. But Jeremy, upon receiving the notice, is going to call the cops. And the cops are going to go to see Joe Smith. And they may see that Joe Smith is angry, distraught, hates Jeremy, has guns, but hasn't taken any affirmative act that would commit a crime. And the cops can't do anything about it. Under current law in Minnesota, they can't. If the therapist can call the police and say Joe Smith is very seriously threatening Jeremy, his neighbor, or is very seriously threatening to take his own life, maybe it'll have a chilling effect on Joe's willingness to go to therapy. On the other hand, it might save Joe's life or Jeremy's life. So what does the therapist do under those circumstances? It's a tough situation, and how bad is the chilling effect? I don't know quite how you strike the proper balance there. One original version of this bill had a mental health professional being able to go directly to file a petition with the court for a red flag order. Upon further discussion and consideration, the language you have in front of you is what we have instead, which is the therapist can notify law enforcement, and law enforcement can make the assessment of whether or not a red flag petition is appropriate. So I don't know how you get around that quandary, Senator Cruen. What we have before us, I think, is our best attempt to protect all the parties that are involved from being victims of the gun violence.
Senator Cruen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, to me, in those situations, a better approach would be to address the whole person and not just simply focus on their gun rights. That's kind of where I go in those types of situations. And I know I've been asking a lot of questions here, but there has been talk too about the gross misdemeanor for providing false information by somebody. The problem with that, as I see it, is when you're in an ex parte hearing, it may not rise to the level of, somebody knowingly providing false information that would be actionable under this bill as a gross misdemeanor. But the judge, of course, is only getting one side of the story. And from my clerking days being part of ex parte hearings, you can get a completely 180-degree picture of what's going on without necessarily somebody rising to the level of perjuring themselves in presenting that information. And I guess that's my concern here, is that you have one side of the story. It could be for vindictive reasons, could be for a whole host of reasons, and that may not end up it being actionable as a gross misdemeanor, but clearly paints a 180-degree different view of what's actually happening, and somebody is deprived of their constitutional rights as a result. And so that, again, to me, comes back to why there should be notice and an opportunity to be heard before this happens. And so I've already said that several times. So with that, I don't have any more questions, but appreciate the discussion. Thank you.
Senator Lotz.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruen, I understand what you're saying, which is why in the bill the respondent is entitled to get into court very quickly, within 14 days, to have a full evidentiary hearing, to lay out all the evidence that they want to lay out, and why it's then the judge's decision to evaluate that evidence and determine whether the petitioner, not the respondent, has by clear and convincing evidence proven that a longer-term order is appropriate. If they don't, then the firearms get returned right away. The judgment is you make a quick decision because you want to at least try to protect the life, and you get back into court a little bit later when things have maybe had a chance to cool down and there can be a little higher standard for the clear and convincing standard, and the judge and everyone can participate. Law enforcement did have an interest in being made aware of petitions that they are not a part of so that they can participate in the ex parte proceeding and any subsequent hearings and so on. And so there is a provision added in the bill in response to their concern that they need to be notified right away. While I have a moment, I also want to say, because there's a question raised about storage and law, because in the sheriff's letter, and we've reflected, and I think we have pretty well addressed that storage doesn't have to be in a sheriff's department where they may or may not have sufficient space. Storage can be at an FFL. We've got funding that's proposed in the bill to offset the costs of that storage. By the way, the route to the courthouse for the respondent that disagrees with an ex parte order or when they make that petition is a clear path. There is no filing fee for them. That's provided also specifically in the bill, so there's no financial barrier from a filing fee standpoint to them getting into court. And it was also raised a concern about venue. We had some long conversations about venue, and the scenario came up where, let's say, you've got a sister who lives in St. Paul and a brother who lives in Duluth, and the brother is distraught and angry. How does the sister get into court on that? Does she have to drive up to Duluth to file a petition? The result was the venue language that's in the bill here, which is that they can get a petition filed. The Duluth court would then be tasked with, if possible, holding a hearing where the sister can participate virtually. Only if the Duluth court wouldn't accommodate that could the sister then bring an action directly in, say, Ramsey County District Court. And I think ultimately the law enforcement agency responsible for enforcing the order would probably be the one where the respondent resides.
Okay, thank you, Senator Latz. Senator Kuhn has another question, then I'm going to go to Senator Howe. We do have to take a technical amendment, and I'll just note that we're at 2 p.m. Many of us have other committees we need to get to.
Appreciate that.
Senator Kuhn.
Appreciate that, Madam Chair. Thank you. I just wanted to clear up. I knew I saw somewhere in the bill that the respondent had the burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence, and I did find it. It's in 1013, 1014, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that is after the follow-up hearing, if they want to get back into court, is that what this one, then they would have the burden of proof on clear and convincing evidence? Because I knew I saw that in there, and maybe you can just explain what that is.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Kroon, once the court issues an order, the respondent will have a right to go back into court at some point and ask the court to vacate the order. And that's where the respondent then has the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that they do not pose a significant danger to others or risk of suicide.
Senator Kroon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there any other ways to get your firearms back other than to exercise the application process contemplated in 1012 through 1018?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Kroon, well, if the order itself expires, otherwise there is a court order in effect.
Senator Kroon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
So, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Latz, with the courts backed up with that 14 days,
that they have to have that hearing? How are they going to meet that 14 days? And if they can't meet that 14 days, then what happens?
Senator Lass.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Howe, the courts are backed up, but not with all sorts of cases that have strict timelines on them. So they can move things around. They can make the space available. They'd have to do it under the law. I don't know if there is any consequence identified in this bill if they fail to do it. I know there's some laws in which, you know, hearings are supposed to be heard within a certain number of days that are set forth in statute, and the courts have included those are directory, not mandatory. But I would expect under these circumstances, the statute says 14 days. I take that back. I'm thinking directory, not mandatory. In the implied consent law is a deadline for the court getting an order out after there's been a hearing. In terms of the hearing itself, it's within 60 days, and that's mandatory, and the hearing has to be heard within 60 days. So unless the parties waive that. So the court would have to find a way to do it within 14 days. I can't imagine that the courts are going to be absolutely flooded with petitions like this. So when they come up, courts find a way to deal with emergency situations all the time.
Senator Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I was just hoping there was something where if they don't do it in 14 days, something happens. But the other question I have is a bill that we just passed off the Senate floor, I believe still this week, with military folks and the restorative justice. How does this dovetail into the restorative justice program, where if they're suffering and they have to go through and they voluntarily go through the program, how does this stop some of those actions, or how does it interact with that?
Senator Lass.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, the Veterans Restorative Justice Act, as I recall it, applies in criminal proceedings and provides a route into restorative justice process for someone who has been charged with a crime, or based on the bill we just passed, potentially before they've been had to go through legal proceedings relating to the criminal process. This is a non-criminal process here, so I don't think there'd be any necessary overlap in it. Now, I suppose at some point, if someone ends up being charged with a crime and they go through the restorative justice process or veterans court, then maybe they've got a grounds for going and bringing a petition under the red flag law to say they no longer pose a risk of danger to themselves or others, and here's proof of why I've successfully completed the veterans court requirements, for example.
Senator Howe? Okay. Council has a technical amendment for us that I'll ask Mr. Backus to walk through.
Madam Chair, members, it's on page 9. Page 9, line 27. Delete 624.7144 and insert 624.7174.
So Mr. Backus, can you repeat that?
Yes, Madam Chair, members. Line 9.27, delete 624.7144 and insert 624.7174.
Senator Lass.
So moved.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Amendments adopted. Senator Lass, final comments.
Madam Chair, just one final thought. The one alternative that's been brought up here and in lots of other places is that 72-hour holds might be an option. And the fact is, every law enforcement officer will tell you 72-hour holds are not necessarily effective in protecting people from themselves. They get dropped off at the hospital. The hospital's busy. They aren't in the middle of an episode at the moment. They're at the hospital, and they can be out the door within a few hours or within 24 hours and so on. They're back on the streets. In fact, the officers will tell you that's part of the problem of the 72-hour hold system. So this provides a pathway to judicial determination that a person needs to be saved from themselves or saved, or others need to be saved from a particular person who is posing an imminent risk of danger, significant risk of danger to themselves or others. Without it, there is no viable path in many, many circumstances. This bill, by the data, will in fact save lives. I encourage your support for it. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, Senator Latz moves that Senate File 1117, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion passes and is adopted. It's on its way to Finance. We are meeting tomorrow. Do you have any additional announcements, Senator Latz?
Members, tomorrow's hearing will start at 9 o'clock. We have a very long agenda. Be prepared to be here.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you.
Senator Latz, the governor's budget bill, I believe, is being heard tomorrow in our committee. There are gun provisions in that. Are we planning on having a lengthy debate on those as well?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, the bills that we have just heard today are the totality of the gun bills that I intend to seek to move out of this committee. I know the governor had a lot of additional proposals in there that we will not be considering independently, and we will not be moving the governor's budget bill as a package itself.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Latz, do you know if there's any members that wish to entertain those provisions on gun laws tomorrow?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I'm not sure which members of this committee.
Right.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I am not aware of any senators on this committee that intend to independently attempt to move any of those other gun provisions that are in the governor's budget.
All right.
Senator Limmer?
And I will pledge to you now, I would resist any such effort.
Senator Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Latz, are we planning to make that hybrid tomorrow?
Pardon me?
A hybrid committee?
Yes.
Tomorrow?
Yes.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you all. With that, we're adjourned.